It's time for This Week in Tech, and it's a small panel, but a great show. Ed Bott is here from ZDNet, Christina Warren from Mashable. We're going to talk about Halt and Catch Fire, WWDC, Apple's big announcements, fighting Google, and more. A great tweet awaits next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 461, recorded June 8th, 2014. Leave Eugene alone. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from anywhere. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. Even present from an iPad. Start your 30-day free trial of GoToMeeting today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple or Android device is worth at Gazelle.com. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For my special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter TWIT. That's Stamps.com. Enter the offer code TWIT. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show that covers your tech news each and every way. Boy, what a big week this was. Bringing together some of the best tech journalists in the biz to talk about the stories of the day, starting with Christina Warren. Welcome back, Christina. The last time you were on, we actually had to punch you because you just, not punch you, punt you.
Yes, I punted myself because my connection was so bad. Yeah. But this time I'm wired in, and bad lighting aside, I'm happy to be here. No, I'm also very tired.
You sound good. You look good. You're tired because you were out here and flew back, right?
Yeah.
Senior tech analyst for Mashable. You were covering WWDC. We're going to talk about that in a second. Looking forward to that. Also here, Ed, my old friend. Good friend for many, many years. Ed and I were just comparing notes. I think I've known him for more than 20 years. Ed Bott from ZDNet is here, author of the Ed Bott Report at Ziff Davis. And I've known him since he was editor-in-chief at, what was it, PC World? Windows Weekly?
PC Computing.
PC Computing, that's it.
Editor of PC Computing, and before that, managing editor of PC World. And I think we were doing... whenever John was not able to do his Saturday morning show, I stepped in.
That's right. Often. Dvorak on computers in the early 90s.
Back and when we would take questions from people, should I upgrade to Windows 3.1?
This Windows for work groups, what does it do?
Right. Yeah, it really is. 3.11 really better than 3.1 for my business?
Exactly. Actually, I remember from that era looking at 3.1 and thinking, you know what? Because I was a Mac fan. I bought a Mac in 1984, and 3.0 was not quite it. But when I saw 3.1, I said, this is bad for Apple. This is Microsoft's caught up. And it's been a tough battle ever since. We are going to talk a little bit about WWDC, of course, in a bit. But before we get there, I think more importantly, did you see Halt and Catch Fire this week?
I
did you? Oh,
I
good.
Like that show. I like that show.
See,
I like it.
When it first, in the first 5 minutes, I was telling Lisa, this is horrible. I'm so, because they had a sex scene right away with the woman who you know is going to be the smartest person on the show.
Yeah, before the
And you know she's going to do whatever. She's going to be the one who says, I'm in. You know?
Right.
In some future episode. And I had, Leo, it's funny because I had the exact same reaction after 5 minutes. I looked over at Judy and I said, this is not grabbing me.
Yeah, well, I was pissed. I felt like, God, this is exactly what happens when networks get a hold of technology, technical material. They don't trust that the audience will be interested, so they sex it up. Fortunately, and it's obvious, AMC said, you know, can you just start with a sex scene?
Yeah.
they got it out of the way. And then the rest of it was great. I was really surprised. I enjoyed it.
And they got the font correct.
What did they get correct?
I want to see next week's.
I'm not going to say it's great yet.
I've seen a few episodes. I got some screeners. And no, the thing that impressed me most, and this was even from the previews that they sent out and some of the trailers, I guess, they got the font correct on the terminal. And that was, for me, no, because here's the thing. Most people, when they do, like, are especially recreating, like, 80s tech, they don't get that stuff correct. And I talked to Christopher Cantwell, who's one of the creators of the show, and he actually has a history making 80s looking stuff. And his father was actually worked in Texas in the 80s as a computer engineer. So he actually grew up in Texas, where his dad did some of the stuff that was similar to Halt and Catch Fire. And he said that their researchers were very dedicated, and that they made sure that they got the correct font for all the terminal scenes.
It's funny that you should say that.
That was correct.
I forgot, but the IBM PC had a unique font. It was designed for IBM, and it was a serifed font. And you're right. It was very distinctive. To get that right is critical. So I didn't even notice, but they did get that right, huh?
No, I showed it to my husband, who's like an old school, you know, computer nerd, and his first computer was an Atari 400.
Me too.
And
yes.
And he, you know, learned to program that way and whatnot. And,
me
and
too.
He's very, very particular about making sure that the stuff is correct. And like, he won't even watch a show if it's off. And so he was even more critical than I was. And he saw the font. He was like, okay, cool. We can watch this.
So I don't think it's spoiling. And we'll be careful not to spoil anything. I don't think there's that much that you could spoil, frankly. It's not that kind of show. But I don't think it spoils anything to say that the plot, it's a fictionalized story of how the original IBM PC, which came out in 1981, was cloned.
By Compaq, yeah.
Well, I don't think it was Compaq. You know, I did some research. Because the company on the TV show is Cardiff Computer, right?
Right, right. I mean, they apparently
Cardiff
live
Electric.
In a world...
Cardiff Electric. Cardiff Electric.
They apparently live in a world where Compaq still exists, but a lot of the stuff... I recently read some book from one of the Compaq co-founders, and he actually did an interview with a guy who does the retro internet podcast or something, and he talked about what... the guys at Commodore or Compaq rather did to reverse engineer.
They came out later than, and I remember this because I had an Eagle computer, and the first clone was something from, do you remember this? You might remember this, Ed, Columbia Data Products.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was, I believe, Columbia that was the first to do this clean room reverse engineering of the BIOS.
Right.
Yeah, there were definitely earlier people than Compaq, but Compaq was the first one. You could get it to work with DOS or with some of this stuff, but it wasn't completely
I see. So the Columbia... See, they did say the Columbia reverse engineered it, but maybe it didn't do... It wasn't a very... I don't know if it was a perfect... I don't remember that.
Are we watching the under 35 readers just... Or viewers just like...
What are they talking about? Is this before...
I'm under 35. I think it's fascinating, but then I'm a weird person.
Christina Warren is very weird. No, this. So remember, the Apple came out in 84. The first, and the Apple II had come out in 77. The Apple Macintosh came out in 84. The first personal computer from IBM, non-Apple, you know, what this was a big deal, came out in 81.
One. Right. 81.
The thing that IBM did that was unheard of, they used off-the-shelf parts. There were no proprietary parts in it. And I think they did this on purpose. You were around, Ed, in this time period,
Yes. And the reason, I knew all the, in fact, one of the original members of the IBM PC team used to live across the street where I live right now. I moved here 9 years ago, and for the first 5 years that I lived here, he was a neighbor of mine, so we used to have dinner regularly, and we would talk about those early IBM PC days. And one reason they used off-the-shelf parts was because they were staying under the radar.
Yeah,
it was a skunk works. In Boca Raton, they went down to Florida. IBM's up in New York.
Yeah, they were in Armonk, New York. And if anybody had known what they were doing down there, they probably would have shut them down. So it was, in a way, it parallels that first episode of Halt and Catch Fire, where they were kind of trying to do this in secret and literally in a garage. And the IBM guys were trying to get this thing shipped without too many red flags showing up in Armonk.
It makes sense because they would undermine IBM's business, which was mainframe computing. And if you put a real computer on somebody's desk, that's bad for business.
Right. And from what I understand, and you guys would know better, but from what I understand, in addition to trying to do it under the radar and prevent IBM from knowing, it was kind of done, you know, they were trying to do it as cheaply as possible.
Right.
So that's why it made sense to use off-the-shelf parts rather than building their own custom chip. And then IBM, once they did release it, IBM really didn't expect it to be successful or even want it to be successful.
Right.
And its success kind of was like, well, ooh, what do we do now? You know, and then, you know.
Oh, crap, we have to manufacture a few.
Right. And then you know, all the mini computer guys, all the, you know, all the digital equipment core guys and everybody else are just like, oh, this is no big deal. And then, you know, a decade later, none of them, including IBM, are making computers.
Did you know Don Estridge by any chance, Ed?
I met him.
Yeah. Yes. He passed away just a few years later in a plane crash. But he led the Boca Raton team that built this. And they not only used off-the-shelf parts, but they documented the one proprietary part. In fact, it's so funny because they're scanning the board looking for the proprietary part. They buy an IBM PC in the show, and they're scanning. Somewhere in here, there's a proprietary. Yeah, it's the one with the big copyright IBM written. You could see it even, you know. So, yeah, that's the part. It was an 8K ROM chip, the basic input-output system that IBM wrote. But they even, in their manuals, documented all the calls. So IBM was really open about this and in a way that you wouldn't expect an IBM to be even in those days.
Yeah, shockingly.
Now,
I mean, thank God they were, but I'm sure they regretted it afterwards.
Well, maybe because, yeah, the clones came. I had an Eagle, which was never reliable. It was one of the early, predated Compaq, one
I
of the early
clones. A Leading Edge.
Leading Edge, remember that? Yep.
Hyundai, I think it was Hyundai who made those.
The reason the Eagle was cool, the IBM 8088 went at 4.77 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
The Eagle, I think, was at 9.
Dude, that's
nine.
Fast at the time.
It was like 8 or 9. It's like, it's twice as fast, but it never was reliable. So I don't, it's a trade-off a little bit. So, but Ed, do you remember, and this is one thing I wasn't sure about, maybe Christina, you know, the way they do it in the TV show looks kind of a little bogus. They have an oscilloscope and they test the leads and they've set up some kind of goofy LED readout and they're writing down hex code. I guess what they were doing is looking at each memory location in the ROM chip and writing down its hex code. Is that right. How you would do this?
That's how you would.
Seems well, like you that, could dump the
they
chip.
They were basically disassembling it. Well, what would you right. dump it into?
I guess.
Right.
I mean, all you need is a chip reader that would just do this. I think you could have, even in those days, just read the chip. It's ROM code, unless it was somehow encrypted.
But that was, we were talking about this. My wife and I, as we were watching it, it was that if as he's writing this down in this notebook, how many of these are there? 65,536. And he goes, okay. And he's writing them down in this notebook. And we're saying, if only he had a personal computer.
He's so easy. I think even in those days, you could get a ROM reader that would give you. So then you get the hex code and now you disassemble it. But now you've got a problem because the engineers who do that now know the code.
And they are contaminated.
They're contaminated. You go back to a decision just the year before. Actually, it may have come down that year between Apple and a company called Franklin Computer. Remember this? The Franklin Ace was a clone of the Apple II. And Apple sued them saying, but wait a minute, your ROM code is stolen. It's exactly the same as our proprietary code. The first court that heard it, the argument Franklin made was, well, it's not human readable, so you can't copyright it. You can only copyright something that a human can read. The first court said, yeah, you're right, Franklin, but they went on to circuit court. The circuit court reviewed it and said, no, you could still copyright own machine readable code. That decision held, and Apple was able to put Franklin out of business. So the folks, whoever it was, Cardiff, Columbia, Eagle, Compaq, that were reverse engineering the code, knew already what the law held. You cannot copy the code. It's copyrighted.
Right.
So what do you do?
So you take the APIs or you take the functional description of the output of the machine and you literally reverse engineer it. You say, what does it take to take input and turn it into this output? And if the output is documented well enough, you can engineer the part in the middle. And where this show, I think, is going to go is about how you can get it 90-95% right, but then you discover the places where you reverse engineer the right result for the one thing that you knew, but then something else happens and it behaves differently.
Undocumented APIs and odd behavior, maybe buggy even behavior.
You have to duplicate the bugs in the code.
Don't just duplicate the accurate code. You have to duplicate the bugs as well.
And I mean, this is in silicon.
Right.
Yeah. There's a book by Rod Canlin, who is one of the founders of Compaq, called Open, yep. How Compaq Ended IBM's PC Domination and Helped Reinvent the Modern Computer. And I read that on the plane, actually, on the way to WWDC. It's a really good read. And he goes into the whole story about what they did to reverse engineer and white room reverse engineer the BIOS and the whole configuration. And what made Compaq unique, as you said, you know, Leo, they weren't the first clone, but they were the first one who made it fully compatible with the software. And beyond that, they were more compatible than future IBMs were with older software.
And Isn't that funny?
Right. And so that was actually how they were able to outsell IBM, that and the fact that they went to the 386 first. You know, IBM kept wanting to do the second one, you know, was 286, and they didn't want to move to the 386. And Compaq saw, as Microsoft did, that, hey, this is going to be like the chip. And so they had the 386 first, and so that was basically how they became like.
So you've seen more than You actually got some screeners. You've seen how many episodes have you seen?
Three.
Does it get good? I mean, do you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, I really like the show. Good. I mean, you know, but I'm somebody who's a total nerd about retro computer history. But I also feel like they're doing a good job with the characters and things like that. But I like the show.
It feels like AMC said, all right, Mad Men's over. What are we going to do?
Totally. Right. Totally. They're like, it's like, okay, Mad Men with computers. But
even this guy is like Don Draper.
Totally. Oh, completely. Completely. It's funny because, you know, they've got the more difficult thing. And I was talking to one of the co-creators about this is that, like, how do you show how people program or how they reverse engineer things or
so
whatever?
Boring. Yeah.
It is. And so that becomes a really interesting creative challenge. And like, you know, The Social Network did it really, really well.
I thought so.
Probably the best of any, you know,
writing the code on the window. I loved that. Yeah,
exactly. And like, you know, that's not exactly how it works, but that can really visualize the experience rather than just somebody who is in front of typing, because that you don't want to see that. And I would say that probably that's the best representation. And actually War Games, which also just celebrated its 30th anniversary, or 31st anniversary, I guess.
Shall we play a game?
Exactly. Yeah, that just turned 31. You know, did a really good job of showing that sort of, you know, how computers work sort of thing.
I interviewed John Badham, the director on the Screensavers some years ago, and he brought a photo album of War Games. It was so fun to see.
And what's so cool.
What's interesting about Badham and the director, did Fincher direct
Social Network?
Is that they both cared a lot about the technology, and even though it was kind of behind the scenes, they wanted to get it right.
Yeah.
There was a scene in The Social Network, you may remember, in class at Harvard, Mark Zuckerberg walks in and the professor poses a very challenging question. Nobody can get it. Zuckerberg in the back of the class stands up and says, well, they shot the whole scene, and the technical expert who was on set to advise them said, you know, that's wrong. And they said, Fincher said, what's wrong? And he said, well, it should say this, and they reshot it. They did it because they wanted it to be right.
Yeah. I know talking to the Halt and Catch Fire creator, he said that when they were working with the technology, A, they had to make sure that they sourced all the stuff that was of that era, but B, they worked with experts to make sure that the actors were holding them correctly and were using them correctly, because it was really important to them to make sure, like, for instance, and again, this doesn't ruin anything, but like in the opening, in the first episode, the wife is taking apart a speak and spell.
Right.
You know, they wanted to make sure that, you know, she was holding it and holding the tools the right way. And they did that, you know, across the board with the series, because they really wanted to make sure that they got those details correct.
And does it feel a little weird now? This is not for you, Christina, but it feels a little weird. As somebody, both of us are old enough to have actually lived that era, and we're covering technology in that era, and we're writing about this stuff. It feels a little weird that that's now ancient history for people. Did it feel that way to you? Well, I mean, I remember, I dressed like that. I had the sidebar, I had the clothes. The music. I was telling Lisa, that was just the other day. I remember that quite well.
That was right before I went into tech. Uh-huh. So I was in the publishing industry then, and I was working with consumer electronics and social. It was a men's magazine that I was working
what
for.
What men's magazine were you working for?
I was working for Playboy.
You're
back
kidding!
In those days.
Awesome.
I did. Yes. Yeah, so
did you do technology? Yeah, did you consumer electronics for Playboy? Like, were you the stereo guy?
For the young men's version, because I was only 22 or 23 at the time, I did stereos, desktop and car stereos. And I think the first Walkman came out a couple years later than that. And I covered some of those and all sorts of little gadgetry. And the first Atari computers came out then as well. And I remember doing an article about how to, for a young man's audience, and this is relevant, having just completed the Triple Crown, handicapping horse races on a computer.
You type it in QBasic.
I can look back and I think I still have some actual typed, and type them on a damn Selectric,
right,
you sent them to someone who then typed them into a linotype machine.
You didn't get one character wrong.
Right. No, I have some old, I collect retro computer magazines, and I have some old ones that, you know, have like pages and pages of, you know, of code, you know, that you're supposed
Christina,
to type
in. I love you. You are in the club. You joined the club. Here you're with two old men who actually were there. And you're still, and you collect this stuff. I wrote for Byte and InfoWorld in the mid-80s. I wrote about Atari for Byte and InfoWorld. I wrote about the first Macintosh for Byte. It's 30 years ago now. It didn't seem
that long. It doesn't feel like 30 years.
It doesn't feel that long. Anyway, you'll see in about 30 years, Christina, you'll look back at this and you go, God, that doesn't seem so long ago I was on Twit.
I would be staggered to imagine what things are going to be like in 30 years.
Can you imagine?
Because the curve, the acceleration of change in that 30 years is, you know, hockey stick.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's possible that in 5 years, our world will be as different as it is compared to 30 years ago today. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how fast things are changing. And that's how fast we have to be willing to adapt to that change. Adapt or just
adapt
get the
or
hell
die.
Out of the way and get run over.
I'm waiting for that day to come, but so far I've been able to keep up, and I love it.
Well, I was going to say, that's why you guys are so great, because so many people, and it's not just in tech, but in other industries, you know, as things progress, they don't keep up to date with what's happening. I personally think it's awesome that you guys were around at the beginning and are still on top of it and like are covering things now, because that gives you like context that people like me, I mean, I only have it from reading stuff and being a fan as a kid, but you have the real context and the real, you know, knowledge of, hey, this is how far we've progressed. And that's so useful, I think.
I'm really feeling it. We'll get Jerry Pornell
I'm
on
not
the next.
Cool. I'm just saying,
you know what? The next time you're going to, Jerry Pornell will join us and we'll really have an old timer.
Well, because then he was like Mr. Byte, right? Like,
right. Chaos Manor. Yeah.
Oh my God! Every month, get Byte magazine and go, holy crap! How many words did Jerry write this month? He was the Stephen King of tech.
Really was something else. Loved him. Love him still, and he's been on Twit.
And
many
he's still
times.
Around.
In fact, Chad, that reminds me, we're due to have Jerry back on Twit soon. Let's get him back on. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We have lots of news to talk about. WWDC. I think the Love Fest may end in a moment. There is other history, too. You know, this is the 30th anniversary of Tetris. We could talk about that. And what is that thing that Amazon is going to announce June 18th? We'll find out. But first, a word from our friends at Squarespace. The all-in-one platform makes it very easy to create your own professional website, your portfolio, or do e-commerce. Squarespace is everything you need. It's the hosting, the best hosting you can get. We try every time I do a Squarespace ad, we try to bring the Squarespace sites down. Everybody can go to inside.twit.tv, our blog, and try to bring it. You cannot bring it down because the software that's running on the site is so tightly integrated with the hosting software that the minute more bandwidth is needed, it's provided. It is an amazing technological design. We've been with Squarespace since almost the very beginning, the days they came out of the college dorm room. And I still think every time I see it, gosh, it's better and better and better and better. New features, new designs, better support. Their support all coming from the Squarespace offices in New York. You're talking to knowledgeable support, people who actually work with the software, work with the designs, the templates. It all starts off at the Squarespace site. You'll see a big get. Oh, that's cool. Did you see that parallax effect? Wow, as you move your mouse around. That's built in. Little CSS magic there. The neat thing about Squarespace, you don't have to know CSS or JavaScript or HTML. You use their software, it couldn't be easier. Start by clicking the Get Started button. You'll be choosing from 25 gorgeous designer templates. But I have to tell you, it's not just how gorgeous the template is. It's what is going on behind the scenes is actually quite sophisticated. This is very modern web design. As an example, mobile responsive. So it looks good on any size screen. In fact, when you upload a picture to your Squarespace site, they automatically size 9 different versions of it so they can serve the version that's right for the screen, whether it's a 4-inch iPhone or a 30-inch QHD display. It's amazing. They always look good. But don't think because I'm starting you with a template, you're going to look like 25 other sites. Every site's unique. You'll see these are all using the template that I selected. Each one has its own unique feel and look. They're very visual because today that's what consumers want. They're great for a photographer, an artist, because they'll reflect your style. You completely can customize it, drag and drop, add widgets to do social media, whatever you want to have in there. Metrics, SEO, everything's done so beautifully. And yes, they have e-commerce, the best e-commerce I've ever seen. This is a perfect example of Squarespace. Didn't have e-commerce for a long time because they wanted to get it right. When they introduced it last year, it was easily the best e-commerce solution anywhere. Let me take you through the pricing, too. Now, you're going to be able to try it for 2 weeks without a credit card. That means you could try everything. You can even import your existing content from any other blog API and right in there. So you can see the comments, you can see the images, you can see what it would look like. Change the template. They're not integrated. They're not wired together. The content and the style and design are completely separate. So it's very easy to try all the different designs. As little as $8 a month with the annual plan, that will give you a domain name registration. You can even do e-commerce on the $8 a month plan. One product, or you can accept donations. Great for a wedding registry, a cash registry, or a nonprofit. The professional site, unlimited pages, galleries, blogs, unlimited bandwidth. And then if you really want to do the e-commerce right, you got to take a look at the business plan. $24 a month, you get real-time carrier shipping. You get label printing. You get integrated inventory and accounting. They set up the credit card for you. So if you don't have a merchant account, they'll help you with that going through Stripe. And all of this, they don't take a cut of your business. All of this, $24 a month. I think Squarespace is really amazing. I want you to try it today. All you have to do is visit squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. You got it 2 weeks. You don't need to give them a credit card or even our offer code. But if you decide to buy, please use the offer code TWIT and you will get 10% off your new site. 10% off when you use the offer code TWIT. Squarespace.com, the secret behind some of the most beautiful websites, the most modern websites in the world. WWDC was this week. Christina, you came out for WWDC.
I sure did. I sure did. And I was very fortunate I got to attend the session. So I won the lottery. So I got to the lottery they had for attendees. So I was able to attend sessions and really get more of an idea of what some of the new stuff was that they announced.
Now, that's something new because in the past, journalists were able to go to the keynote, but then they kicked us all out.
Right. And they did actually let some journalists get developer badges. In this case, I'm a registered Apple developer, so I won the keynote in that respect, and I paid for my badge. But what was different was that they lifted the NDA on discussing what was in the sessions.
See, that's where you would be at a disadvantage, because you don't want to be a developer, because you could you go in there and you maybe know everything, but you can't say a word.
Right. So you still can't put up screenshots and they don't want full reviews of stuff, but we could talk about everything that they announced, the APIs and whatnot, which is frankly, it's about time because so many developers have felt, I think, encumbered and afraid to, okay, how do we talk about this stuff now? Because They announced so much stuff. They announced so much stuff that I think that to try to keep it all under wraps until the fall would be, A, it would be untenable. Everybody breaks NDA anyway. But B, it really wouldn't be good for the developer ecosystem as a whole.
Did you? You didn't go, Ed.
You know, my ticket never arrived.
Ed's a little known as a Windows guy, I'm afraid.
No, you were at Build, though, right? So, you know.
Yeah.
I was at Build, and in fact, John Gruber did an episode of the talk show with me. We at Build, we did a live
good for John.
One-on-one discussion. It was so much fun, and it was so interesting, and it really, I think, you know, a few heads exploded over that. But the reality is that Mr. Gruber and I have a tremendous amount in common. We both love technology. We both happen to be experts on the platforms that we've spent time serving the users and developers of. But that doesn't mean that we're somehow agents of those platforms. We just happen to be experts in them and advocates for the people who use them. And so we had a lot in common, and it was a tremendous conversation that we had there. And he made a joke at the end, you know, I've got to get you to WWDC and maybe next year, because I watched the entire keynote, you know, made a few snarky comments on Twitter, but overall was quite impressed with a lot of what I saw. Not all the jokes.
Yeah, some of which were at Windows expense, and so I would understand why you.
It wasn't even that. There was only, I think, one joke about Windows. There was a lot of anti-Google
stuff
Google, there.
Yeah.
It was very. In fact, that was, I think, one of the big themes, one of the big takeaways of everything from WWDC for me was that Apple has said quite clearly with the things that it's doing here. First of all, we want to make it, if you are fully invested in the Apple platform, Mac, iPad, iPhone, and all the apps and services that pertain thereto, we're going to make your experience as good as possible. The more of our stuff you buy, the better your experience is going to be. But the other thing that they've done is to open things up, both in terms of apps, but in terms of services. So there's a lot of synergy now between Microsoft and Apple. And it's almost like, despite the one pie chart up there, there was a great deal of respect and synergy between Apple and Microsoft products. And there was literally no respect or synergy between OS X and iOS and their counterparts, Android and Chrome. Christina, did you get that takeaway?
Completely. I mean, it was very clear. I mean, and it makes sense too, right? Because John Gruber, as you mentioned earlier, you know, his app, that Vesper that he does with Brent Simmons and with Dave Wiskus, the new Sync that was just released is built on Azure. And I mean, iCloud itself is an Azure.
Can you confirm that? Because that's been said for a long time, but we've never confirmed it.
I can confirm that. I can confirm that. I'll just say sources close to Apple.
Very interesting. Yeah, because neither side, neither Microsoft nor Apple has ever said officially. But Azure, which is Microsoft's cloud platform, powers Apple's cloud platform, iCloud.
Right. And so, but it was also interesting that they were almost going out of their way to, as Ed said, very much make it so that if you're a full Apple person, like I am for my personal use, everything works together better. But also, the underlying thing was almost to say, we can take Google out of the equation as much as possible. So, you know, that comes with some of their search stuff with Spotlight and how it'll search other parts of the web too. You know, that comes with, you know, adding these extensions and adding these additional features that it's not so much because users and developers want and need them, because they do, but it's about, okay, well, this might convince you to no longer use Chrome, or this might convince you to not switch to Android. And I thought that was really interesting. Even stuff like the iCloud Drive, you know, that people have been wanting for ages, it almost seems more of a response not to Dropbox so much, but to Google Drive and wanting to keep people from migrating to the new enemy, which, you know, is Google.
Yeah, it's interesting how both Apple and Microsoft are now aligned in a new axis, a new alliance against Google. But what I do like is it seems as if both companies are saying we will provide an alternative for people who want Google-like services but don't want to give Google all that information. And that's a,
definitely,
at least from a marketing point of view, I'm not going to speak technically, but from a marketing point of view, that's a good position to take.
No, I mean, and it comes at a very advantageous time, you know, because people care about that more than they did a year ago. You know, it was just a year ago this time that the Snowden stuff started leaked. And I think that in a different universe where we didn't have all this news stuff and the paranoia around privacy and security was so high, that the fact that, you know, you have to give certain things up, namely, you know, aggregation of your data to get these access to these services, most people were more than willing to make the trade-off. And I think that still most people are willing to make the trade-off. But in that climate and with kind of this increased conversation, there is a real opportunity from a marketing standpoint, whether or not it's true technically or not.
Well, that's my question.
An alternative.
Can you say that it is more private, safer to use Microsoft or Apple than it is Google?
I don't know if you can say it's safer. I think that you can say it's more private only insofar as they are not selling services and paying for things based on what your data says.
Well, they make their money in hardware in the case of Apple and in hardware and software in the case of Microsoft. But they do. Apple has iAds. Microsoft sells ads.
Of course. You know, and that becomes the big question is to say, okay, they are taking this data. Are they storing it? And are they manipulating it in other ways? Because I think that would be the big question. From what I understand and what I've seen, I don't think that they are, but it doesn't negate the possibility that they could at some point, you know, switch things around and say, now we want to do more of what Google's doing, which is offering you a more custom experience based on the data we have on you. I mean, but that's the thing that
well, that's one advantage to giving Google that information.
Yes,
is they could do things like Google Now and say,
right,
hey, I know you're looking for pants. You're passing a pants store with a sale right now. Apple
right.
would never do that. Microsoft would never do that.
No, and I think that, you know, Google is a little bit ahead on that. I think that that is a very great, that's an awesome feature of Google Now. But what's really, really, it's creepy, though, because right now, anyway, to me, Google Now is creepy because I don't enable it. If I enabled it and said specifically, I want this to work, then I would feel better about it. But the fact that it's just on, that serendipity thing that might be awesome and is more, is quite frankly, really probably the direction we're all moving in terms of privacy and how things work. They, because
don't you
we're
think
not
Apple
place,
will get, Apple will get to a point where, and maybe Microsoft too, where it wishes it did have that data.
Yeah.
No.
And at that point,
okay,
no,
good.
Yeah.
So you say, Christina says no. And Ed says yes. So go ahead, Christina. What do you, or do you want to let Ed, you want to think
no,
about
go
that?
Go on Ed. Yeah.
No, well, so, Google's, revenue once the Motorola deal closes to Lenovo, Google will be back to making 90% of their revenue from information that they gather from their customers and sell it to other people. It is literally their revenue stream,
right,
is information. Apple's revenue stream is hardware, software, and services. They have displayed consistency through the years about taking information that they gather about their customers, credit card numbers and so forth, and using those to make those experiences better. Microsoft tried to compete with Google in the advertising realm with the acquisition of Aquantive back in 2007, maybe.
Acquisition they ended up writing off for billions of dollars.
They wrote off $6 billion. They wrote off one third of a WhatsApp on
yeah,
that. And I think, I know from doing the reporting during that time that there was a great deal of fighting within Microsoft over, this is not us, we should not be doing this. And it was, you know, well, let's see, this, if this is the future of the internet, then we need to be here. And they tried to do it and they couldn't succeed. And so they said, you know what? Let's exit the dark side. They still sell ads because advertising drives the modern internet. You can't
right.
be a player in the modern internet, even Apple, even Microsoft.
Well, if they still sell ads, then it's just a matter of degree. It's not that they're not collecting information. It's
no.
Just,
well, no.
Go on, Ed.
If you're taking if your goal is to gather as much information about your customers as possible and put it into databases and allow those databases to become as large as possible because that is your product, then that's different from let's collect information to help us serve more effective ads and throw it away and not exploit it in the future. Those really are pretty bright lines that are pretty far apart.
So you say Google is not merely collecting information to show ads, but they're saving it for some future use.
Absolutely. I think that's without question, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why they are so successful right now is that they've been taking our information, our searches, our destinations, our activities, and that's why Google Now works, right?
Like they claim that's to improve search results because
it certainly does. But at the same time, something like Google Now would not work if you didn't have this backlog going back a decade of information.
Well, and that's my question: aren't consumers going to want Google Now like features? And
I think,
won't Microsoft and Apple be hobbled by the fact that they haven't been saving this information?
Yes, but and that's what I agree with. I think that no question at some point that will probably become the expectation. But I think the big key difference, and this is what I think Ed is saying, is that Google also, it's not just that Google uses that information, it's that they also sell that information. However, it's anonymized, you know, but you're still, information about you is then sold to other people. And I think that's the disconnect where ads that, right. AI ad is not a very successful product, first of all. But
yeah, but doesn't mean they didn't try. It just means they didn't succeed.
No, of course they did. but they didn't try very hard. I mean, if they did try hard, then wow, because that was a big
Again, it seems a matter of degree rather than intent.
Right, but I think that it's one of those things where you can sell ads without making the user database information available. And whether you can be successful, obviously you can't. But
well,
they
Google would say
streams.
We don't give personal information about Christina Warren and Ed Bott to anybody. We sell it in aggregate, as does Facebook.
Right. I mean, except for the things like the plus ones and some of the other information. I mean, there's you might not be able to identify it directly with a person, but all of your information for your profile is linked together and sold to an advertiser, which to some people is still creepy. So I think that, you know, Google's core business is all about advertising and targeted advertising. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's their core model. So as much data as possible and making that available to as many people as possible and getting as many people as possible to use their products is their business line. Whereas Microsoft and Apple, obviously they might be able to use that stuff internally, but they don't make it accessible externally to other companies. And that's because they have other legs, so to speak, you know, on their chair of revenue. They can sell, you know, software, they can sell services. In the case of Apple, hardware. And that's, I think, the big difference is the one is primarily an ad information company and the others, you know, it's an ad hoc thing. And if they are going to use that customized information, it's what they are using. And it's not something that they could make available to a third party so the third party could use it.
I mean, I'm a Google fan and I like Google Now and I don't care what Google knows about me. But I do think that this is a very great position to be in one respect for both Apple and Microsoft, because you now provide an alternative to people who are discomfited by what Google does.
No, Google, I think absolutely.
Google is essentially to the private sector. Well, and I am not trolling here, I promise. Google is to the private sector what the NSA is to government information.
Well, they're the NSA without jails and tanks.
They are. Well, the NSA doesn't have jails and tanks either. The NSA is signals collection.
I understand, but they act as an agency of information for people who do have jails and tanks.
And Google owns DoubleClick.
The worst Google can do is advertise to you. They're not going to arrest you.
No, except they have information that they turn over to the police as well.
But so does Apple and Microsoft.
Oh, yes. Absolutely, they do.
None of these companies are successful as much as they might try in keeping the government's hands off of this information.
I completely agree. I think the difference
that
is just the level.
That train left the station long ago.
I would agree that that's a big issue, a privacy issue. I would argue that's one we should be concerned about. But no company gets away with that. There's nobody saying no to the NSA.
There's no question. Everybody's, you know, complicit. But when you have so much more information, I think that's where it changes so much. You know, whereas, you know, Google knows more about me than anybody. You know, I type in G.
Who knows more about you? Your internet service provider, should they choose to collect that information. And most do on behalf of the government. They know a lot more about you because they know everything you do as opposed to Google, which only knows what Google thinks you do.
Well, what's interesting, Leo, is, you know, and we have this every time I'm on.
I know.
Eventually we get around to this.
Well, I just want to defend this side of it because I agree. Oh, totally. I agree. All of these positions are completely legitimate. I don't mean to dismiss your position at all.
Here's the thing. Google is actually a small part of an industry that's even larger, which is the data aggregation industry, which is dominated. There's companies out there whose names you have never heard before, and they're gathering information from Google and DoubleClick and advertising providers, but also offline sources.
Right. Yes.
Government agencies, public records, private surveying companies, and all of this information gathered together. And if you talk to people who know intelligence gathering, people in the government and outside the government who know intelligence gathering, they'll say when your ISP actually knows a relatively small amount about you. But when you aggregate all of this information and the offline and online stuff together, the inaccurate picture that you can build of someone is much more frightening than the accurate picture. And that's the
fear. So give them more information, Ed.
Well,
let's make sure it's an accurate picture.
Yeah, you know, the trouble is that you don't know
you don't control it.
What information they own. You're not in control of it.
Right.
You don't know. And so either if something erroneous gets in there or something that could be misinterpreted.
You just look at your credit report if you want an understanding of how this can happen and what it can do.
Sure.
Or that guy who after the Boston Marathon bombings a year ago, who was at his office. He was married to somebody else, and that's how it became a story because she was she wrote something up on Medium, but he was just curious about whether this was
possible. Well, he was turned in by his employer, by the way.
Right, the key
understood. There's the point. So imagine he hadn't been turned in by his employer, but that had simply gone into a database of search behavior that then got linked with something else and linked with something else. And all of a sudden
there's not much recourse to that. If you're recourse is to get off the internet.
No, you're dead on. And what I always say about this is that I acknowledge that any guise of security and privacy from any of these companies is a facade. And I acknowledge that no matter what I do, whether I avoid Google or use other things, that it's a facade.
Apple and only use Siri for your searches so that Google doesn't see those searches.
Of course. And it's a complete but even though I intellectually know it's a facade, there's something I think that this is why I have a problem right now with Google now. Even though I intellectually understand that the information is available and is being aggregated by someone, not Google anyway, there's something about seeing it presented without me giving my implicit or explicit rather permission.
It's the creepy factor that you don't like.
Right. And now in 10 years, it probably won't be creepy. In 10 years, it'll be the expectation. But the problem is, I mean, it's kind of the same thing.
The future because I love it. I want to bathe in Google data.
Totally. But it's kind of like, I think the expectation is sort of like Google Glass. It's like, this might be where things are going, but if you're too early, you can creep people out too much.
And Violet Blue go too far in her rant against Google? Thank you, jerk face. Did you read that?
Oh, yes, I did. Well, you know, it's on the same network.
It's CDNet.
At CDNet.
And, thanks for nothing, jerk face, she writes.
Thanks for nothing, jerkface. And I know where she's coming from. It was very heartfelt. There was a great deal of factual accuracy in it. My colleague Jason Perlow has written a follow-up piece to that for ZDNet. Consider it an op-ed. You might be able to find it there and post the link.
What is his response?
Basically it's Violet, you knew what you were getting into when you signed up for this thing.
Yeah.
One of the reasons Violet Blue has a particular axe to grind here is she was a victim of what she calls the NIM wars. Early on in Google Plus, she wanted to use her name, which is obviously a pseudonym. And Google said, you have to use your real name. And this was a big problem. Her point, though, and I think it's an interesting point, is that Sergey Brin, who apparently was a big proponent of Google Plus and admitted last week that Google Plus was a mistake. He said, it was a mistake for me to be working on anything tangentially related to social to begin with. I'm kind of a weirdo. In other words, he didn't get it, as I think Mark Zuckerberg doesn't, the idea of privacy.
Great.
And he designed Google Plus in a way that made sense to him. One of the policies, of course, the real name policy. Now, you could say, well, of course, Google wanted real names. It's the best way to collect data is to have a single definitive right. name. We can stack all that data underneath. She calls it their velvet glove cast in iron policy. She, of course, was a victim of it. But at the end, she, you know, I think it's very emotionally charged what she's talking about.
There's one fact in there that I think goes back to what we were just talking about what's the problem with them collecting all this information from you. There were a bunch of people who had either YouTube accounts or some other sort of Google account.
Whistleblowers. Whistleblowers,
but no.
Transgender, who hadn't revealed that.
They were people who were not out at work as
right.
being transgendered. And then all of a sudden, Google flipped the switch and said, guess what? Now your name is going to be attached to everything that you've ever done in any Google service. And so people said in graphic four-letter words, oh, my goodness.
Well, and she refers specifically to a person who says, I'm really pissed right now. I was not ready to tell any of my coworkers, but right. she was outed in effect because her real name was associated with her
and handle. The whole thing was, this wasn't like it wasn't like someone said at Google, oh, by the way, we're going to do this. You've been using this service all along. They've allowed you to have a name that allows you to remain relatively anonymous. If someone knows who you are, they could come and find you there and track you down and play private detective. But all of a sudden, Google flipped a switch and told everyone in these people's offices that they're, you know, in the early processes of right. of doing transgender assignment, gender assignment
right.
surgery. And that's there's the nightmare scenario, is something that you thought was you've been discreet about, that you certainly don't want your neighbors, your friends, your right. family to know about. It's not because it's illegal or immoral. It's because
it's your personal right to privacy. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a real problem. I mean, you know, Netflix was sued, and this was a case I actually don't think Netflix should have been sued, but it ended up killing off that whole 1% project that they were working on, you know, to increase the accuracy of Netflix predictions, which was a great program because a woman said that her Netflix history and Netflix recommendations for her outed her to her employer. I think that is a little bit different than because nobody can see your Netflix recommendations. You know, I'm not sure how the employer saw them. But I think that is a little bit different than what Google's done with some of the real name stuff. But it's a real problem because, yeah, we all have a right to privacy. And it becomes a yin and yang, you know, between, you know, how much I think that most of us would be okay if a service knew our name, but aren't okay with them revealing it to the broader internet. And that's where the disconnect happens.
Yeah, I think that Violet Blue really describes this in a strong emotional way, but I think also her feelings are probably and will increasingly be echoed by others. Google search is no longer the clean, she writes, clean, high-performance tool we once relied on and admired. Now it's a fetid stew of Google Plus littered, screwed-up mystery mechanics running under the misguided assumption that anyone and everyone only wants more of their own location, their connections, Google's clumsily guessed interests, and Google Plus favoritism and the results served back to them. She says, Google Plus tells us Google thinks of us as little more than webs of flesh spun over packages of saleable data. Whether that's accurate or not, and I think it actually, you probably can't say it's inaccurate, I think this is a sentiment that is going to be increasingly popular. And I think this is an opportunity for Microsoft and Apple.
It is. I was having this conversation with somebody last week at WWDC, and we were talking about DuckDuckGo, you know, the alternative kind of search engine. And even though they are, you know, a very small team and it's basically one guy trying to compete against the likes of Google, and they're doing a good job at it, the scariest part, and I mean this not in like, oh, my privacy or whatever, but one of the reasons Google has such a huge advantage is because they totally changed the way that search engines and recommendations and those things happened. You know, back in when Google kind of debuted in 99, when they were, you know, powering Yahoo search, the aggregators and the search systems then worked in a completely different way than they do now, where you crawl everything. And for me, I understand her emotional argument, but I think maybe the better unemotional argument is that, for me anyway, Google searches have not become as good because they are so tailored. I want to see the best result.
You believe in Eli Pariser's filter bubble, the notion that you're now kind of living in a bubble of your own creation.
Without a doubt. I mean, bias confirmation is a very real thing. Yeah. And if I'm trying to find information about something, I don't really want to see my own results first. I want to see what's best from the internet as a whole. And you do get that from data aggregation. I think that's really good. But I think that if you just personalize, you can do too deeply personalize things where it no longer is serving the best info. But at the same time, how do you really compete with Google? Because even Microsoft, who's been trying to do search for a long time, they've had such a huge head start, and they have so much data that for anybody else to compete, I don't know if it's possible without many, many years of doing things, and also, frankly, probably collecting as much information. I don't know if it's even possible to come up with an alternative that is as accurate, whether it's personalized or not.
Well, I think Apple must have sensed this change in the zeitgeist, because it seems very clear they're taking aim straight at Google. It's toxic hell stew and Android, and removing.
That was another ZDNet quote that was actually on stage at WWDC.
Adrian like Kingsley ZD, Hughes. ZDNet's
getting, yeah, that was Adrian Kingsley Hughes. ZDNet's getting a reputation this week. I guess I better say something.
Start writing some inflammatory prose here. You're not using enough.
When I'm the calm, measured guy,
You got a problem. Well, I think Apple, we're going to take a break, but come back. We will talk about actually some of the things Apple announced at WWDC. But I think this is a real opportunity for Apple, and it's very clear they see this as an opportunity. And one of the main points of WWDC, both with Yosemite, the next version of OS X, and with iOS 8, is we're going to get the Google out. Even if you do a search in Spotlight now, you might have some Google search results in there, but they will be disintermediated. Apple will show up in the Google search result, not you, or in this Google search information, not you. They do offer DuckDuckGo. Can I get some clarification? Isn't DuckDuckGo using Google? Are they just sanitizing the results?
Right.
Both. Yeah. So right now, they're basically using Google, but they are also cheating on their own.
It's kind of cheating. If you want to use a Google service, the deal is you give them information. And it's kind of cheating. Say, well, I'm going to keep the information myself, and I want to use the service. Don't use Google. Bing.
We can get sidetracked. We can get sidetracked on this for an entire segment. But there's companies like Ask.com, which have built an entire business around taking Google search results
and repackaging it,
putting their own crappy ads on top of it, which are served by Google, and so delivering an ad heavy. Horrible.
Okay, that's crappy. But DuckDuckGo's results are just repackaged Google results.
For the most part. I mean, there's no Google. Most people don't realize this. As many APIs as they have, there's no actual search API, and that's probably to prevent more of exactly what Ask does and even DuckDuckGo. So you have to creatively reverse engineer or scrape different results. From what I understand it, and I might be wrong, and so if I'm wrong, I'm sure people in the chat or on Twitter will tell me, but I think that DuckDuckGo is also looking to increase its own scraping capabilities to offer their own results too. They would have to, because if all you're doing is having anonymized Google results, then for a lot of people, that's not going to be enough of a good experience.
But this is one advantage Google has. There's a huge barrier to entry.
Yes.
For creating an equivalent to Google, and it gets bigger every year, especially as Google aggregates personal information and other things.
Right. I mean, that's my point. I don't know if anybody – I don't think that the next Google, at least in the model that it works now, I don't think it's possible that anybody could really build or truly compete with it, building it from the ground up, unless – I actually don't even think, because there's just not enough time.
Right.
So much of it's Maps is the same way. Apple Maps was a problematic product for lots of reasons, but one of the main reasons is that Google Maps had a decade almost of built up information, and also for many years users themselves sourced a lot of the location and destination information, and that made the product so much better over time. So trying to build your own with buying companies and saying, oh, we can just put this together and it'll be an equivalent. Well, no, actually it won't.
So this is what DuckDuckGo says. They get their results from over 100 sources, including DuckDuckBot,
our own crawler, crowdsource sites like Wikipedia, Yahoo through
Distant
Boss,
cousin of mine.
Yandex, which is another search, Wolfram Alpha, Yelp, and Bing. But they do also say, while our indexes are getting bigger, we do not expect to be wholly independent from third parties. Bing and Google each spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year. I think it's more than that. Crawling and indexing the deep web, it costs so much that even big companies like Yahoo and Ask are giving up general crawling and indexing. Therefore, it seems silly to compete on crawling. Besides, we don't have the money to do so. So don't expect an independent competitive search engine from DuckDuckGo, Yahoo, or anybody else, frankly. Although I have to think somewhere in a laboratory in the basement at One Infinite Loop, there is a team trying to create Apple Search. It really feels like that. You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. That's
then it feels like they're stealing Google's results.
Christine is absolutely right. That is the resources that it takes. It's an entire business to build there.
Very expensive.
And you can do mapping. You can do a lot of specialized types of information that you can do. But to be a general purpose provider of information at your fingertips is a massive business all of itself. And it's a tar baby, too.
Right.
Because once you get involved in it, you can't let go. You have to just keep throwing money at it. And if you're competing with Google, for whom it's the primary source of business, they're going to break you. It's going to be like the Cold War.
Yeah.
You know, where you finally put the Russians out of business because they couldn't keep up with the Cold War.
We'll take a break. I do want to talk about some specifics from Apple. There's a lot more to talk about. The Turing test. You know what? This show should be 8 hours long, and even then, I don't think we'd get to enter. The Turing test, is Uber worth $18.2 billion? A whole talk about barriers to entry. There are none. There's a whole lot more to talk about. We got a great team, though, to do it. Ed Bott is here from ZDNet. Christina Warren from Mashable. Great to have you guys on. This is fun. Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting. Folks, you got to meet. You may not like it, but if you're in business, getting the heads together all in the same room around a table is probably the only way to cut through the Gordian knot of confusion and disagreement. We have a 3-email policy. If you can't solve it in the email, you're going to get together in the same room and hammer it out. It's where creativity happens. But nowadays, everybody's on the road. There's offices all over the world. How do you get people in the same room when they're not in the same office? You do it with technology. Millions of small business professionals, big businesses too, rely on Citrix GoToMeeting, the solution, the one we use and recommend for meeting and collaborating online. With GoToMeeting, you share the same screen, so you're on the same page with documents, presentations. With built-in HD video conferencing, you can see each other face-to-face just like you're in person. And because you pay one low, flat monthly rate, you get to have as many meetings as you want, as long as you want. I know many teams keep GoToMeeting running all day long. You can present, demonstrate, and just simply meet anywhere with any Mac, PC, tablet, or smartphone. You can even present from an iPad. See why millions choose GoToMeeting. You can start hosting your own meetings within seconds right now. It's very quick to sign up, and you've got it free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and just do me a favor where it says, what's the promo code? Use the promo code TWIT, and they'll know where you heard it. GoToMeeting.com, 30 days free when you use the offer code TWIT. So, let's see. iOS 8, no hardware was announced, contrary to some rumors. Mark Gurman at 9 to 5 Mac said there's going to be hardware. Nope. And Apple's done it before. It wouldn't be unreasonable.
And Mark Gurman is usually very good about those things. He's not Gene Munster.
Notoriously bad. I was surprised. We had Mark on TN2 Tech News Tonight that afternoon, and he said Apple changed the name of HealthKit to Health because of him, which I think is going a little far. But it wasn't called HealthKit or HealthBook. It was called HealthKit and Health. And they did not announce any new hardware, but they announced so much in software that I think that's probably fine. A 2-hour jam-packed keynote. that went off without a hitch, I thought was very well done. I think Apple was very on point in the presentation. I have to point out, though, that it's all air until Apple does it. And they can say, we're going to do iCloud Drive and we finally get the cloud. But their history shows they don't. So there's the home automation's great, but you got to get everybody to sign up. Health Kit is great, but if you have no health devices of your own, it relies entirely on third parties, and they didn't make mention of any iWatches. They say you're going to be able to work in the iCloud Drive just as you do with Google Drive or Dropbox. Not available yet. They say you can say, hey, Siri, and Siri will respond. You'll be able to take a picture of your credit card with your iPhone and pay that way. All of these. But you guys believe this is all going to happen.
Well, I mean, execution is always the problem with Apple, right? I mean, especially when it comes to the cloud stuff. And it's the problem for everybody. I mean, you don't know until you execute. I think that, for instance, iCloud Drive, there's absolutely no reason to believe that it won't work as well or better than Dropbox does.
Do you say that? They have never been able to do this.
No. What I mean is the integration with Finder. I don't mean the cloud services itself.
But
I mean,
I'll give you an example. iCloud was supposed to have document sync for the last 3 years.
No. Oh, I'm not talking about the sync in the services. I mean is...
I'm just saying they have no track record to say that you should have confidence.
No, in cloud, absolutely not. But what I mean more is as how it natively integrates to Finder. That's all I mean.
You know why it's going to work? Because it's based on Azure.
But all of it's been based on Azure.
I'm just kidding.
Right, of course. But execution is the big key. And that's where I'm the most, I guess, skeptical is with any of the cloud stuff, whether it's CloudKit or iCloud Drive or anything else. The taking a picture of your credit card thing, yeah, that's going to work because they've had the ability to do that with their gift cards for several years.
That's true. They're just hold up your barcode. You're right. I forgot to the camera, and it registers
absolutely.
It. Yeah.
Well, and there are other. Every bank can do that with checks.
I know.
Today.
I mean,
that's not exactly.
Okay.
No,
all right.
I mean,
all right.
Uber does it. Uber does it too. So I think that'll work. But I think that the executions cloud is where I'm worried about the execution. I don't think they're going to have any problem signing up all the big players for either HealthKit or HomeKit. I think they'll all sign up. But again, it comes down to execution and is this going to be the best way we do things?
I'm excited. They said everything right.
Yeah, no, totally. But you're right. I mean, the proof is once this stuff launches, will it work the way we say it will?
Yeah.
I'm most excited about things like handoff and continuity, but I'm also
cool too. You could be working on your desktop. Now, of course, this promotes the idea that you have only Apple hardware, but if you have an iPad and an iPhone, you can hand off documents as you go for various devices. Can we do that? We can do that in Office 365, can't we, Ed?
Well, yeah. So there's two different approaches to things here, and it's solving the same problem from two different ways. Microsoft's approach to continuity is to say everything is in OneDrive, and so if you it saves automatically as you go. So if you are working on something on your phone, and then you walk into your office and set your phone down and sit down at your computer, you can open up Word or Excel or whatever you are creating that document in, and there it is in your you just click the file thing, and there's the file that you are working on, and you click it, and you're right exactly where you left off. There's a slight amount of friction in there, but I'm not sure that the absence of friction that comes with walking in and having my document magically show up on my Mac when it was on my iPhone is anything more than demoware.
Right. It does feel like demoware, doesn't it? Yeah.
I don't know. I'm frequently in a position where I'm working on something, either a document or an email or something else, and I get called into a meeting and I have to make a split second decision. Do I take my iPad or do I take my MacBook Air with me?
Right.
And the ability to pull it up instantly where I am without having to go through that friction. And I agree, it's minimal. It's definitely minimal. But I think having a lack of that is a good thing. But I think the bigger thing is that, if you can do it, it'll work with iOS and Mac apps, obviously, but it'll also work with a web page. So that means that you can, send off where you are in a web page or a web app too. And that's really useful, especially if the web page has maybe an iOS counterpart. So I think that, there's a lot of potential there for the handoff stuff. But I also really like the fact that, for instance, I can answer my phone call, my iPhone from my Mac now. And I can make an outgoing call from my Mac without having to use a third party tool or go through other gyrations. And those might be edge use cases, but Ed is right. I mean, the way that Apple and Microsoft are approaching this sort of continuity thing, and Google for that matter too, are all taking different approaches. You know, Google, it's always about the cloud being first and foremost, you know, that the web browser is the destination. Microsoft, it's all about OneDrive. And with Apple, whether they'll succeed with the execution or not, and again, the execution here, I think more important than anything else, is absolutely key. If you can't rely on it, you won't use it, is to make the service aspect, the cloud part, disappear and just make it, you know, app-based so that, you know, it will be able to kind of work seamlessly. But I think that part of it is probably demoware, but I can see real use cases, especially when I'm working on something and then have to immediately switch locations, and I might not want to take the same machine with me.
It's, and even if it, you know, is demoware, it certainly sells Macintosh, iPad, and iPhone, because you
definitely,
even if you never use this, you do want everything to work together smoothly, don't you?
Yes, in a way. I wrote a column about this week, and I should have put it in the show notes.
That's all right. I think we can find your column.
What's interesting to me is that, you know, there's some neat new stuff and some interesting borrowed stuff in OS X Yosemite. But a lot of it is just basically refining what we all know is a desktop operating system. There's very little that's new in there. The desktop operating system, Yosemite, it has become, to many extents, an extension of the primary device, which is the mobile device.
Isn't that interesting? What a switch that is, huh?
Yeah. So one of the big slides, I think I put it at the top of the column that I wrote, it should be the most recent one on my page there, is Tim Cook standing there, 80 million Mac install base.
Right.
80 million is the same number of phones. Windows 8 phones.
Isn't that funny? It's got the same penetration as Windows 8 phones.
Yeah, and so
that's wild.
200 million iPads and 500 million iPhones sold. Now that's not the installed base, but it's actually pretty close because they're both new categories, and so very few of those devices have been retired or destroyed. So you've got something, you know, probably 600 million Apple mobile devices and only 80 million. Mac devices. So I know the continuity thing, although it's interesting, it really seems to me to be more of a way to appeal to us journalists who still carry around the big purpose, all purpose devices.
Well, is it also that a lot of Mac, iPhone and iPad users don't use Macs, they use Windows machines?
Yes.
Of course, there's no continuity.
And for that. And so that to me was the thing there was almost I like the way this is working together. If you happen to be all in,
it's your reward for being all in.
Totally.
Your Apple Platinum.
Yeah. You got an Apple Platinum account, baby.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and
you do have to wonder, I got to say, you do have to wonder if Apple will respond to this by putting more of their services on Windows. My guess is they will not.
I agree. I think that, you know, iCloud Drive is there.
iCloud
will be.
Really? You think so? Okay.
They announced, scroll down that same article and you'll see the screenshot.
Okay.
And what's interesting about that screenshot is that.
There you go. iPad, iPod Touch, Mac, or PC.
Yeah, and they even showed a demo or a very brief Windows screenshot during the keynote. To be totally fair, before iCloud Drive, managing your iPhoto stuff, like your photo stream, was actually easier on the Mac on Windows than it was on the Mac because you had a visible place where you could see all the photos. And on the Mac, they've had kind of a hidden directory that's you've got to go through a bunch of gyrations to try to find if you want to just see your photo stream. And pipe it in from the web. I mean, you know, make no mistake, and I wrote about this when retaining to the Apple buying Beats thing. You know, the iPod was a success for one primarily for one reason only. It had Windows support. I mean, like, we can't, you know,
much as Steve Jobs didn't want it.
No, but he realized that's the only way it could work. And right. the same thing, you know, the iPhone more clearly, well, I mean, just looking at the number of install base, clearly, you know, more people have a computer running Windows.
But that's my question.
iPhone owners.
Maybe because aren't we in that post-PC world where maybe they don't have Windows or Macintosh?
Yeah, I think that what Apple's take is, and it's decidedly different than Microsoft's, is that we are in a post-PC world, but we aren't in the world where it's all one system yet. Whereas Microsoft seems to be wanting to say that we are all in the system where you can have the same interface, the same basic code base, the same everything, and you can access, you know, all of your devices virtually look the same and have some of the same, you know, features. Apple is taking a very different approach in that we can make these things work better together, but a laptop still has a different use case than an iPad or a phone. And I personally, in how I use things, that's true. I think that it's very fair to say that more people might be using their primary devices as a phone or tablet. That's totally fair. But I think that when you are using a laptop, most people don't use it when they're doing things on it other than web browsing. Most people use it considerably differently than they do when they're on a tablet or phone. So rather than having, you know, the artist formerly known as Metro interface, you know, kind of dominating the entire thing, it's about rather than having everything have the same interface and feel like it's part of the same platform, this is all about you use these devices for different things, but we're going to make it easier for you to use those devices together. And then at some point down the line, maybe it makes more sense to unify everything under, you know, one name and one core interface.
Let's see. Home. This is something that Google's trying to do. Microsoft's been trying to do for more than a decade, the idea of unifying home automation systems. Nobody's succeeded. It's a tower of Babel of different protocols. Nothing talks to anything else. Going back to the days of the X10, can Apple unify this system and make it work?
I think they will do a better job than anybody else has in terms of getting people to sign up, getting manufacturers to get kind of, you know, the MFI, you know, made for iPhone, made for iPad, made for home certification, which is one big part of the challenge, right? And it's interesting because HomeKit has like two parts. So one part is that you can use your iDevice to be your interface controller and that, you know, you can use that to control everything. But the other thing is you can still have your individual apps. And there are a lot of people who are trying to aggregate and kind of create a central dashboard for home automation. There's ZoneOff, there's Revolve, there's SmartThings. I think that Apple will probably have more success just because they're Apple, and the people who are buying right now anyway home automation things still tend to skew more Apple than other types of devices. That doesn't mean that won't change over time. But as we're finally entering a place where, you know, the idea of home automation is no longer Crestron and other super expensive, super difficult situations, but Philips Hue bulbs and the Nest thermostat and things like that, Dropcam, things like that, they will have a better chance of getting everybody under one roof. I don't think ultimately they might be like the name in home automation, so to speak, but I think they can definitely push things towards a certain standard. And that's desperately needed. You know, I mean, I think that I've always argued that being late is just as bad as being early, rather, is just as bad as being late. And I think that as much as Microsoft has put into a lot of the home automation stuff, they were just too early. And now
as they were with tablet computing,
completely, you know, and the timing is everything. I think that right now the reason that I think that Apple could succeed has less to do with the fact that their technology or that even their approach is any different, but is because it's the right time. The stuff has gotten easy enough to use and affordable enough that it's the right time. And I think that Apple also by making it very clear that all the devices that are HomeKit enabled can talk to one another and see one another is something that the other platforms that are trying to kind of bring everything under one roof have not done. For instance, if you change the name of a device and it's connected to HomeKit, every other device in your system will see that the name is changed, so that it's not going to display. If it, say you had living room one and you changed it to, you know, basement, that basement will show up across things without anything having to update. And those are the sorts of details, especially when it comes to trying to do more complex setups, that I think are really important. So, you know, Apple brings to it kind of a more humanized, I think, approach to making things work together, so that, you know, your mom can use it. But I think the timing is probably the biggest reason they will probably be successful, at least at getting people signed up. Again, execution is everything. If it doesn't work correctly, then no one cares. But I think that the timing right now and the fact that they do have such a good name when it comes to getting people to adopt things, especially early adopters, will probably bode well for them, at least in getting all the major players to sign up and agree to, you know, maybe not at the expense of others, but to add, you know, HomeKit support into their devices and software.
I would buy an iPhone 6 if they make it a bigger screen and it could talk to all my devices. And
it ran Android.
And it ran Android. You took the words right out of my mouth, Ed Butt. We're going to take a break. We got lots more to talk. Are there any other announcements that Apple made this week that you guys, that I have overlooked?
Swift.
Swift, I was going to say.
New programming language.
Awesome.
Oh, everybody's got new programming languages.
But a new programming language. This one just cracks me up because
it's C-sharp.
And I think it's great that they're doing it, and I'm completely understanding of and supportive of the reasons for doing it. But I will tell you what: if Redmond had done the same thing, the machine gun fire would have been relentless.
But didn't Redmond do the same thing with C-sharp? Isn't that essentially what C-sharp did, was take the old C cruft out of the language and make it more modern and more secure? Isn't that what C-sharp was doing?
Yeah. You know, basically, and took fire for it. But this is what you have to do. And so what Apple has done is to say, well, we're introducing this new language, and you should learn it now and start writing programs in it now. But a year from now, a lot of the stuff that you've written will probably be deprecated because we're still learning. And
did they say that really?
Yes.
That's not good.
No, I mean, I think
who would write in a language that's going to be deprecated?
It's not the language that's going to be deprecated.
The calls.
But that's how languages have to evolve. You have to try them, and then when things don't work, you fix them.
Right.
And the only way you get it to... So I completely support Apple's approach on this, but it is also one of those things... It is remarkably Microsoft-like. In fact, one of the themes of WWDC that I saw was, you know, Microsoft this year, with Satya Nadella coming on board, he picked up the one Microsoft thing where the different divisions are not responsible for different products. They're responsible for making sure that all the technologies work together on all the products. And I thought you could have just as easily put a big one Apple slide at WWDC with people saying, this is no longer just for iOS. This is no longer just for OS X. This is no longer just for this piece of hardware. Everything has to work together. And everything in our frameworks and languages and even down to the chip level support is going to work together that way. And I think, you know, it's funny how, although the companies are as different as they could possibly be in many ways, they're converging on a lot of the same ideas.
Well,
one Apple.
It's the same business. To be fair, Apple never had the internecine warfare that really, I think, hobbled Microsoft for
without a doubt. I mean, if you hadn't had the DOJ thing, then Microsoft would be in a different position than it is now. I mean, that made a lot of challenges. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this one, Ed, but I think that one of the things that I really like about Swift, and this is something that even though, well, A, there are two reasons why they're getting this response they're getting and Microsoft's not. One, the number of developers who in the enterprise work with Apple stuff is almost non-existent, whereas, you know, when Microsoft introduced C-sharp, you have a much bigger, you know, contingent of active working developers who are going, oh my God, you've just screwed up everything I'm going to do. But the second thing is, and this is what I think Apple has always been great about, and this goes back to when they switched from, PowerPC to Intel, and it even goes into the, you know, Carbon to Cocoa transfers, is they make the things work together. So your Swift code will compile and sit and work directly with Objective-C code. Now, and they will be supporting Objective-C until, you know, it comes to a point where it's so used minimally, if it ever comes to that point, that it won't be used. So there's not as much of a risk if you're building a new app to try to say, well, I want to go ahead and learn Swift, because Swift can't do everything Objective-C can do, but you can use the parts together. When C-sharp came out, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that it could sit side by side in the editor and in the IDE and work alongside, you know, the C and even like the you know, the VB stuff. It seemed like it was a completely new thing.
Yeah, right. Well, different era, different customer bases, and different even size of applications. Right.
Yes.
The simplicity of the app model in the modern era is in the favor of making a change like this.
I think Swift's interesting for other reasons, too. It's an attempt to make a language that...
that developers don't hate?
Semicolons, but also that promotes secure programming, eliminates a lot of the constructs and the things that programmers do that get them in trouble. I love the playground, the idea that you can... I think this is a smart move because it encourages young people who are learning to program to do it with Swift.
Yes.
And so that could be a great way to kind of grow a body of Swift developers.
I
downloaded from Git over the weekend somebody wrote Flappy Bird in Swift.
So cool. I love that they did that. And because I learn languages by taking stuff apart.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it and I was so impressed that they were able to do it so quickly.
Like
literally.
Like in a day.
It was up in less than a day. Like Swift had been out for less than a day and there was already a Flappy Bird.
Which may say more about how simple Flappy Bird is than how
it
good
does,
Swift
that's
is.
Why, but isn't that why it's the perfect Hello World app, right? Like it used to be tip calculators and now it's Flappy Bird. And I think that Flappy Bird works even better because you have this kind of visualness. But yeah, I mean, I think that the guy who was responsible for Swift at Apple on his own blog, he said that one of the things for Playgrounds that was his inspiration is an IDE, and it was originally Kickstarter-backed, called Lighttable. And Lighttable does the same sort of instant preview thing. And it's a great way to work with a language, especially if you're new to it, whether you're a kid or an adult. Having that live preview thing is so good. And I think having it built in at the IDE level is just awesome.
It's pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that really puts them. I mean, Microsoft always has had really good tools. Google, not so much. But Apple's really stepped up their tool game to a tremendous degree. You know, they've always had really good interface tools, but some of their code stuff hasn't been as good. And that was one of the things that, looking at Xcode 6, I was like, wow, they've really, really stepped up their game.
The company that did the Flappy Bird for Swift is called Fullstack. They're at fullstackedu.com, and they're going to do a Swift course. The reason they did that language, of course, that game, of course, is to as the kind of the cornerstone of their. It's using SpriteKit. It actually shows how well the Apple technologies work to do something stupid like Flappy Bird.
Yeah, well, they've certainly got to the point where there are enough iOS developers and. So mostly iOS to go back to my earlier point, mostly iOS developers. And so the idea, I think most of them are going to say, we don't have to use Objective-C. That's a win.
Yep.
It's
a nice looking language. I liked it. I was impressed by it.
I was talking to a couple of current and former Microsoft people about Swift, and one guy had worked in their mobile division for a long time on iOS stuff, but he worked on other stuff at Microsoft too, and he was really impressed. And one guy I talked to, he is basically a C# developer by day and used to actually work at Microsoft, and he said that he's wanted to learn iOS for a long time, but the barrier to entry of learning Objective-C has kept him out, and that looking at this, especially since the syntax, I mean, it's most similar to Ruby and Rust, but it's also very similar to the way that C# works, and C# is a great language, that he feels much better about going into iOS development. And then that's something he feels like he can even take back to, you know, the decision makers and stakeholders at his company. If they want to say, hey, we need to build this, we need to work on iOS, he's not going to get as much blowback because of Swift. So I think that there are a lot of reasons why it's a good move. But I think one of the big ones, as Ed points out, you know, there are a lot more iOS developers. But I also think, you know, if you're looking at how do you get the next generation of developers or how do you convert current developers into coming to your platform, having a better language that is more approachable is certainly a great way of doing it.
Christina, did you talk to anybody who had considered the future integration prospects of Xamarin and Swift?
Xamarin, we should explain, is the .NET clone created by Miguel. Was originally Mono by Miguel de Acasa. The company Xamarin, a lot of speculated that Microsoft might buy them, but that did not happen at Build, and I think may not happen at this point. And it does allow cross-platform .NET development.
You know, I hadn't, but I don't really know a lot of people who work in Xamarin or Mono or whatever. But I think that, but that's a good point. I'll actually reach back out and see if that changes anything. But I
that
did
would
not
be
talk
amazing.
To anybody. But that would be really interesting to see how that will work together. Yeah. I'm sure that the Xamarin will start incorporating Swift stuff.
Oh, they have to. I mean, that's their whole reason for being
right.
is to integrate different languages so that no matter which language you use, you can use
right.
the same frameworks and you wind up with code that is portable.
Currently, the tagline on their site is create native iOS, Android, Mac, and Windows apps in C Sharp. So
right.
it'd be interesting to add Swift to that.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. There's so much to talk about.
We got really geeky there for
a
little
geeky
while.
Is good. There's nothing wrong with geeky. I like it a geeky. And we should say Visual Studio 14 is almost ready. The first test build just came out. I got in a little argument because I like Xcode. And somebody said, oh, Xcode's a horrible IDE. I said, well, it sure beats Eclipse, which, of course, is what you use on Android. But I guess Visual Studio probably is the king of the hill on that.
Yeah.
No argument there. All right. Our show today brought to you by Gazelle. If you've got a new or maybe a not-so-new iPhone or iPad or a gadget that you want to get rid of, maybe you're thinking of getting that new HTC One. Ooh, is that a sweet phone? Or maybe you got a Moto X and you're going to look for the Moto X Plus One. Go to gazelle.com right now. You can get a quote for your old gadget even before you stop using it. Those quotes are good for 30 days. It gives you plenty of time to wait for the announcement, wait for the new Amazon phone, if that should come out. And you'll get top dollar because I can tell you one thing, nothing in your closet, nothing in your pocket, nothing in your on your desk is gaining in value. All of this stuff depreciates rapidly. So get a quote on your old iPad. Get a quote on your old iPhone or Moto phone or maybe you've got a Surface tablet. You'd like to get the new one. At gazelle.com, we'll even buy broken iPhones and broken phones of all kinds and tablets. Give you top dollar for it. Give you 30 days to take advantage of it. Once you've got all your gadgets in there, you've got cash sitting in those drawers. Then you pull the trigger, you check out, and they will send you a box prepaid postage so you don't have to pay the postage. They'll turn it around fast, and you'll get check, PayPal, or if you get an Amazon gift card, an extra 5%. Great for people who spend on Amazon. I always get the Amazon gift card. It's totally risk-free. Gazelle has paid now more than $100 million to over 700,000 customers. They really are great. They'll wipe your data if you make if you can't wipe it yourself or you forget to. They take care of that. Really, they're fine about that. I like Gazelle. I want you to try it. Those gadgets are not getting any more valuable, and they're definitely, like sitting on cash just to keep them in your drawers. Not the way to do it. Look, you can get your Nexus 7 out. $67. Actually, that's not bad, given that the Nexus 7 was only $200 to begin with. Gazelle, Gazelle. .com, the best way to sell your gadgets. Simple, fast, and easy. Well, if you were a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy named Eugene Gustman, you might have taken this little thing called the Turing test. I love it that Bobby Llewellyn, who's a friend of this network, he plays Crichton, the robot in Red Dwarf, and it does some great podcasts, was one of the judges in this. The 60th anniversary yesterday of Alan Turing's death was commemorated by the Royal Society in London with a Turing test. Now, you all know the Turing test. The idea is if a computer can convince a human judge that it is a human itself, then it passes the Turing test. Alan Turing conceived of this in the 50s. And I don't think any computer has ever passed the Turing test, but maybe it's fitting that it was on the 60th anniversary of Turing's death that Eugene Gustman fooled Robert Llewellyn and Lord Sharkey. Llewellyn tweeted, "Turing test was amazing. Did 10 sessions of 5 minutes, 2 screens, 1 human, 1 machine. I guessed correctly only 4 out of those 10 sessions. Clever little robot fellow."
So it was 33%. Success ratio for the
Turing test.
For the robot, right?
Yeah, yeah. But that's all. That's enough to technically pass the test. I don't know what it means. In fact, the AI researchers I've talked to said it's a terrible test. But
Eliza was able to fool
some
researchers.
Yeah, not for very long.
Back in the days. Well, yeah, not very many and not for very long. But still, the point is, it's not it's a question of degree.
Right. And this is, I'm sure this chatbot is something like Eliza, right? Unfortunately, Princeton's got it running, but I guess so many people are pounding on Eugene that I haven't been able to get in. I really wanted to. Yeah, I was really trying to ask some questions.
Leave Eugene alone.
We want to talk. The fictional Eugene has a father who's a gynecologist. He has a pet guinea pig. If you ask him about it, he'll say things like, "My mom is always shouting that this dirty pig is a pig anyway, in spite it is a guinea pig, and wants me to give it as a gift to any one of my friends for their birthday." Now, that sounds like a bot to me, but remember, he's supposed to be Ukrainian. He doesn't speak English very well. He was created in 2001, and he's been getting smarter ever since. In 2012, he fooled 29% of the judges. I guess we can now say we have Eugene, the weirdest creature in the world. And as soon as the Princeton site is back up, you can bet I'm gonna be there chatting with him.
So he's like a real-world version of the robot in AI, Haley Joel Osment's character in Steven Spielberg's.
Oh, wasn't that sad? You know, better than that, though, was her. That was, I tell you, it sounded just like Scarlett Johansson.
Nope. No spoilers yet.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
I haven't seen it. It's probably next week.
It's so good.
Yeah. It's so good. Get it on Xbox or I was going to say iTunes, but it's on Xbox as well. So or Microsoft's movie store. So
it's not free on Netflix yet, but
won't be
for years.
I'm willing to pay for it. I still pay for content.
The only thing depressing to me is that we'll all be wearing high water pants in the future.
Yeah, the fashion's a little bit odd. but I love Spike Jonze, and I loved it. I thought that was one of the best representations of AI.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Spike Jonze. He hasn't made a bad movie.
No.
And apparently Saturday Night Live did a parody of her with a character they called him. wait a minute. Let me see if I can find this because this sounds good. Let's see if this is.
So this will be good if actually a Saturday Night Live skit was funny this year because.
Has it been a bad year? here's the parody, and if you've watched the movie, you'll kind of.
A few questions.
Actually, let me go back.
Are you social?
Because they got a guy that looks anti-social. a little bit like Keanu Reeves. Not Keanu Reeves. River Phoenix.
Joaquin Phoenix.
Well, thank you.
Artificially intelligent operating system. We'd like to ask you a few questions.
Okay.
Are you social or antisocial?
I guess I haven't been very social lately.
What do you like in other people?
It's kind of a hard question. I guess I don't get along very well.
This is
well
very much like people. The movie. Actually.
Thank you. Please wait as your operating system is initiated.
Hello. Hey, what's up? You sound like me. Oh, yeah, I guess I do. Is that
Jonah Hill?
No, you actually have quite a lovely voice. Thanks, I like your voice too. It's very likable. Thanks.
From the makers of Her.
Sometimes I just feel really lonely. Sorry, this is boring. No, I love listening to you.
Really?
Yeah, you're like funny and great, and your mustache is great. You have like an amazing mustache.
Me.
I love those pants.
You sure they aren't too high?
No, honestly, I think you can go higher.
Story of passion.
I wish I was in that room with you. I wish I could touch you.
Pretty much this is her.
Touch me. I can't. Don't be shy. Just say it. Well, I guess I'd start.
Maybe we should pause here and let the rest of you watch this at home in private. I like Jonah Hill.
Narcissism factor is
spot on.
Do you think? Okay, see, Ed, we have to leave that out of this, but this is just between me and Film Girl.
Okay.
Do you think we will live in a world like that sometime? I feel like that's just around the corner, where an operating system actually sounds like a human.
Oh, totally. I mean, I've always, it's like every year we get closer and closer to Minority Report.
I don't care about waving around screens. I want Scarlett Johansson to talk to me on my computer.
Right. No, I mean, which would be great. I mean, I, I would listen to ScarJo. I wouldn't listen to Sean Penn, but I would totally like to have a ScarJo. Yeah,
who would you? Clooney.
Clooney.
Clooney. Hi. Hey, girl.
Yeah, exactly. His voice, he's got a nice voice.
Yeah, I agree.
He's got a great voice, yeah. And then you could just tell that he's, you know,
a nice guy.
He'll settle down with the right girl. You know, maybe if she's French and something special, like maybe he'll settle down. Like, I would totally pick Clooney.
You have a shot. Yeah. I don't know. I suppose it's supposed to be a cautionary tale because, I mean, really, these people get sucked in by their devices and spend a lot of time looking.
I was going to say, you know.
Screens. Wait a minute.
Right. I was like, are we not already there yet?
I think we're already there. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody in the viewership of this program, Leo, is.
No.
No.
Hey, if you missed anything on Twit this week, you missed some really good stuff. But fortunately, we've cut it all into a small bundle and you can digest easily right now.
Previously on Twit. Twit Live Specials.
What Apple showed today is the advantage of owning the whole system.
I think if you're a developer or you understand the Apple ecosystem, you can see what a massive announcement this was.
Almost everything they talked about was laying a powerful groundwork. You know, you look at the health stuff, look at the home automation stuff for entire industries to build the Apple ecosystem into something much more powerful.
Tech News Today.
International telecom giant Vodafone said in a report today that governments have direct access to the company's infrastructure.
Reading between the lines of the report, Vodafone are calling for an end to this. Six countries have secret cables which can siphon off any data that the governments want.
MacBreak Weekly.
No hardware, zero.
Chiller.
This was 4,000 new APIs, yeah. A host of new functionality.
They didn't need any of that. They didn't need new hardware. They didn't need, you know, new devices, nothing.
The subtext of this keynote is, Andy, please switch back to iOS.
Marketing Mavericks.
So as a CEO, what would you do differently if you were the CEO of Best Buy?
The question to ask is always, if a company didn't exist, would you have to invent it?
If you missed Twit this week, you missed a lot.
And Andy, they're saying your Skype is particularly clear today, so that's nice. Once in a while,
it's going to be so weird not to have Skype to blame for my misjudgments.
That was a lot of fun having all the MacBreak Weekly hosts in studio on Monday for the WWDC announcement. But we got a big week coming up. Mike Elgin of TNT has the story.
Coming up this week, Bloomberg's next Big Thing Summit begins Monday, June 9th in Sausalito, California. E3 Expo starts Tuesday, June 10th at the Los Angeles Convention Center. And Samsung is holding an event in New York City on Thursday, June 12th, called Galaxy Premier 2014. We're expecting some new Galaxy Tab tablets. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Mike Elgin. This has been a crazy month. Starts with WWDC, Samsung. There's some Amazon thing coming up on the 18th. And then, of course, Google I.O. Google will get to kind of put the period on this. I imagine Google will respond in some way, not directly to what Apple announced. Any thoughts about Google I.O. coming up?
I want to see more wearables. I'm really excited. I'm expecting to see maybe the official unveiling of the first two Android Wear.
Do you think we'll see the Moto 360?
I think we'll see that and the G Watch. I think we'll see both
of
them.
That'd be cool. So what is this? What is this thing Amazon is announcing on June 18th? I think it's their 3D phone that was rumored earlier this year.
Sounds about right.
But why?
It's weird. And I don't even think press invites have gone out. I mean, it's one of those weird things where I think they had like a sign up or something. Like,
anybody can get an invitation.
No, they're right. If you want to go, sign up.
In fact, it was on the front page. Look, it's on the front page of Amazon. You go to Amazon.com. Want an invite to our new unveiling? Hey, everybody's the press now. I think that do you think they'll just eschew press invitations? They do give you the chance to create your own video saying why you should go. Let me show you the video, though. This is really weird that they attached.
That is awesome.
Will you freeze frame it at the spot where they accidentally show the
yes,
thing?
Yes, I will.
Whoa.
That's really cool.
It's amazing. It's very real life and uncomparable to anything I've seen.
I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, this is neat. This is really neat.
I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
That's super awesome. I don't know how you guys do it.
It's pretty flawless and seamless.
Wow. Flawless what?
It's really cool. How does it do that?
Whoa. Glasses free 3D?
That's pretty good.
You think that's what it is?
Impressed. That's pretty damn intuitive.
Now,
that's really cool.
I would use that a lot.
Here come the glasses.
Really cool.
Okay. That. If you zoom in, center, enhance, zoom, you can see something. It definitely looks like a phone. It's not. It's too small to be a tablet. That's probably a phone.
Yeah, and you can see the back plate of it in the on the sign-up sheet.
Yeah.
Well, actually, and Business Insider did a freeze frame of that. I thought it was that same video where they had cut down to that woman, and you could see the top of the thing she's holding in her hand, which was clearly a smartphone.
Yeah. Why would I want a glasses-free 3D smartphone?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's better than having to have glasses. I mean, with LG. I agree, but I
we've seen 3D phones before. I don't. Okay, let's.
Right, but you had to use glasses with the LG one. I mean, right. It's still 3D is weird. I don't get it. But it makes it easier to touch things. I don't get it.
I don't get it either,
Christina. That's because you're old.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm clearly feeling my age now because I don't get it. But I don't really get 3D. So
you're one of us. In
the movie theater, I do, but I don't really get like
you kids. You watch everything in 3D. I don't understand it. 2D was cool good enough for me and my kids.
Now, if it had holograms, if the whole experience was like I had hologram versions of my products.
Aren't we going for more immersive? I mean, if we could get more immersive, look at the Oculus Rift.
Which is awesome.
If we could get it more immersive, like you're really there. Okay, but this is a phone. To me, I'm surprised Amazon's not pushing other things. Like, for instance, they could make this very low cost or even free.
Well, they're not pushing anything yet, Leo. This is a teaser video. Oh. There's no content in it. You won't know until you get there on the 18th.
Okay.
What it is. All you're doing is going on rumor sites.
I'm not even going on rumor sites. All I see is people going like this with their head.
That's awesome. Like, it's like, it looks like it's really there.
How do you do it?
Now the funny thing is, watch that video with the sound off.
Oh, okay. Let's try it now. then they really look dorky, right? No sound. All right, let's repeat. No. I like the part where he's going, this guy.
They're all looking down.
They're all looking down, yeah.
Like, at their...
Yeah.
Wow, that's big. It's round. Wow. Ed. say hello to my little friend.
What can I say?
You've got a dirty mind, Mr. Bot.
I have to confess, it's Joanna Stern.
Oh, really?
Joanna, I love you so much. That's so great.
That's the first thing Joanna thought of, huh?
She's the one who suggested that, and Joanna deserves all the props for that.
That's amazing. Yeah.
You're looking at all the props, right?
Yes,
now.
It's the props. All right. What could Amazon do in the phone business that would make it compelling? Look, there's a lot of competition.
Well, look, they have tablets. They have an amazing ecosystem, and phones are the essential part of a mobile experience. So they need to be there with a Kindle Fire phone.
Okay.
Here's my only question.
So their thing has also been, we'll do Android without Google.
Right. It is Android, but no Google. Yeah.
Right.
And our store is big enough for people to put apps there.
Right.
Go ahead. No,
I was just going to say, I totally am with you, but I understand why like the Kindle Fire tablets make sense and why the Fire TV makes sense. I mean, at least in the U.S., Amazon's content ecosystem is arguably more powerful and easier to use than Google's when it comes to things like music and movies and books. And that works great on a tablet or on a Fire TV, but on a phone, you need email, you need a web browser, you need search. And they don't really do those things, and they don't really do them that well.
Well, they have
the
Silk browser. It's not.
Yeah, but it's terrible.
Yeah.
So, like, what do you do about how can? But they can't put the Gmail app in there, and that's what a lot of people want, you know, for their phone. So, what's the benefit of getting
Android without Google services as compelling?
on a phone. I would say on a tablet, it's fine. But on a phone, like, I need my Gmail. Like, I've got to use third-party access.
Yeah.
I love my Kindle Fire, but I'm saying I don't know if I want to use, you know, a phone where I don't have the Chrome browser, especially if it's Android-based, and I don't have the Gmail app. Like, that's sort of the whole reason you put up with the crummy Android overall experience is because the Google services are so good.
I am glad that there is somebody like Amazon out there that can, you know, challenge the incumbents and create something. We'll cover it June 18th. They haven't announced the time, so I don't know how we'll cover it. It may overlap with some of our other shows. We do a lot of shows on Wednesday, but assuming it's in the morning, we'll be able to cover it on Tech News Tonight.
It'll be at 5 a.m. So they'll be able to get it to you with a drone the same day.
I was going to say, the drone's got to be part of this. Like, maybe it's like a remote control for your drone that's in 3D with gesture-based stuff. Like
will it be carrier independent? Will it be unlocked? Or will they have carrier deals? When will it be available? How much will it cost?
If they don't have carrier deals, they're in trouble.
Okay. Because you have to sell it subsidized.
Right. Because
people don't put in SIM chips. They don't go,
they don't.
Right.
I mean, the Nexus, the relative lack of success of the Nexus smartphones proves you need to have carrier support.
Good point.
You need to have them in the stores.
You have to buy
it from the carrier. Have to have carrier support. And they have a really good retail presence already with the Kindle stuff. So I don't think that would be hard. Price, they're willing to subsidize stuff pretty low. So, I mean, I think that if they could
Jeff has always said, we make money when you use it, not when you buy it.
Exactly.
So if you're an Amazon Prime customer, you'll get an amazing price on this thing, I would expect. And the one thing that I – one piece of speculation that I heard, I wish I knew who to credit with this, but I can't remember, so remind me, someone. Someone speculated that perhaps they'll figure out a way to deliver free – 4G or LTE data to it, an amount that's big enough. Now, that's not unheard of.
No, you can get 200 megabytes now on many devices.
Right, like WhisperNet or whatever.
The original Kindle had WhisperNet,
right.
And they've had deals. I think that deal was with Sprint or T-Mobile, which was Sprint.
Yeah, Sprint, and then now it's AT&T, I think.
Yes,
so it's entirely possible that they could be bulk buying some data packages from a provider and make that part of the thing, so that you have an entertainment device that's also capable of doing communication. Of sorts, but I don't know. I'm as curious and skeptical as anybody.
They didn't with the Fire TV. They didn't really make any put differentiators in. And it plays games, I guess, is one differentiator. But it's basically like a Roku or anything else, right?
Yeah, but it plays games. That's the big differentiator, right. And it has the voice search. That's the other thing. The voice search is really good.
Okay.
I think basically, that those are the two things. So. I'm with Ed. I'm very curious, but I'm also like, I don't quite understand. But I'm a huge Amazon fan, so I don't want to write off the idea that an Amazon phone couldn't be compelling. I just kind of don't see the use case right now, but that doesn't mean that I won't, because, you know, they've surprised me in the past.
Well, if they're selling a phone, there'll maybe one fewer carrier to subsidize it. Bloomberg is reporting that the merger between Sprint and T-Mobile is imminent. The company will be renamed SoftBank USA. SoftBank owns Sprint. And that T-Mobile CEO John Legere will run the newly merged company.
Good. Yeah, so that's super smart. He's amazing.
Is the bright spot at T-Mobile. He's turned that company around. And you could argue that Dan Hesse at Sprint has done the opposite.
Oh, Dan Hesse is awful, but Don,
John
Legere.
Don't mince words there, Christina. Man.
Well, I'm sorry. His commercials alone were Sprint is whatever. But what's interesting, I think, is that, you know, SoftBank will be buying T-Mobile from Deutsche Telekom and then keeping the two divisions run separately to prevent, I guess, antitrust things, which makes sense. Then maybe at one point merge them. But John Legere, the T-Mobile CEO, he is my favorite CEO right now. Like, I love him so much. He doesn't mince words. His public appearances are always fantastic. He's always witty. And, you know, they've made some really, really good moves that have kind of brought the company back. I mean, the only thing that they're missing is a really compelling a network. You know, they are still just in little pockets, which hurts them.
So they'd have to unify networks to make this make sense.
Yeah, but they could maybe do that by doing share, which is kind of what happened. Sprint and used to do a lot of like MVNOs with, you know, like Metro PCS used the Sprint network, and then, you know, T-Mobile bought them. It's possible that they could maybe expand and do spectrum sharing deals. So even though they're two separate companies with two separate books, maybe they use the same space.
That's so kludgy.
It is, but if you think about it.
But you got to get it past regulatory approval.
This I was going to say, if the FCC is not going to approve it, and the main reason I think the FCC would face, and the FCC for that matter, would face challenges is because Sprint wanted to buy T-Mobile when AT&T bid. And so they got butthurt that they got outbid. And so they used the fact that we need four carriers, three carriers is not enough. Like, that was the cornerstone of their argument to prevent that deal from going through. Right. So how do you then argue a few years later that no, really three carriers is fine. It just wasn't okay when it was the other guy who outbid us.
I think that argument's pretty easy, actually, because in every other aspect of our modern tech life, we're down to one or two choices.
Oh, I don't disagree.
For everything. Just, so three is
big.
Like,
huge.
Three?
Oh.
Three?
No, totally.
Okay. Well, we're happy to have three. And actually, when AT&T, when you're dealing with a duopoly of AT&T and Verizon, who basically...
Which were AT&T. You know,
are carving up the market as, you know, as they wish.
Like Time Warner and Comcast.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and both of them are former AT&T subsidiaries, which is the funny thing. They're both baby Bells. You know, Singular and...
Cellular Bell One, Atlantic. Right? Or Bell Atlantic.
Bell Atlantic,
yeah.
And Bell South, which then became Singular. Those are...
Wait, so does this make this... I'm trying to remember my high school biology. Does this make this meiosis? Are all of the cells all coming back together
exactly.
now?
Exactly. I really think that that's been what AT&T, through whatever naming convention you want to use, has been trying to do since deregulation hit. They've been trying to do everything they can to come back together, and they're almost there. I mean, I'm with you. I see the argument for three. I'm just saying I think it presents political challenges when you spent so much time and effort lobbying for four, especially if you're a foreign company like SoftBank, but at least through Japanese and not Chinese, right?
So it's a little different, though, than AT&T trying to buy T-Mobile, which regulators put the kibosh on in 2011.
Right. No, it is.
Because you've got the two weak parties, and they can make the argument, both Sprint and T-Mobile, that hey, you need to let us merge because we both can't succeed.
And I think that's very fair. I mean, you know, and Deutsche Telekom has been trying to get rid of T-Mobile basically for almost, God, I don't even know how long. I mean, they actively were trying to unload them.
They have another problem. One is CDMA, one is GSM.
Well, but that's not as big of a problem as you would think. It's really more about the spectrum buys, because Sprint, after WiMAX crashed and burned, thank you, Dan Hesse, in their face, and was a colossal failure.
Clearwire.
They switched to Clearwire, but they called it WiMAX. But since that crashed and burned, they've started to shift to LTE. And as part of the...
Everything's LTE, that it doesn't matter.
Right. And but more than that, I mean, T-Mobile got a lot of AT&T spectrum because that deal didn't go through.
$6 billion. In cancellation fees from AT&T.
Right. So they got that, plus they got access to some of AT&T's LTE spectrum blocks. So they're actually running closer to the same frequencies. And so if you look at that, as everything goes, LTE, that's not going to be as big of a problem. The problem, of course, is that actually Sprint has the smallest LTE blanket of anybody. So they still have to rely on CDMA. But that wouldn't mean you couldn't sell new phones that only worked in LTE, maybe in specific markets. Maybe you don't sell it everywhere, but if it's a market that has LTE access, you can do it. And then it would like maybe backbone to whatever T-Mobile's GSM offering is, which is pretty robust. It's slow, but it's robust.
It's not only that.
This is Masayoshi Son.
Yes, Son. We knew him well at ZDNet.
We have both worked.
We've worked for him.
Leo, you know, us old guys, we've all worked for Son. At some point, he has 500-year plans.
Let me also point out that he announced just last week that they are making emotional robots. And SoftBank said they will go on sale in February for under $2,000. Pepper is its name, and the robots will be staffing stores, SoftBank stores,
great.
As well as watching your baby. Son is a piece of work.
It's
amazing. I want Pepper. I still have an Aibo. Remember Sony's
robotic
dog? I need
a touring test for that.
You want to meet Pepper? Here you
I
go.
Want Pepper.
Here's Pepper. Hi, I'm Pepper. I have an English accent for no apparent reason. And I have eyes that don't work.
but I am able to articulate my joints, roll around, and boogie-woogie. Look at my butt. Why do I have one? No one knows. I can't sit down on it. Maybe it just makes you feel better about me. What is he, directing traffic?
I guess so. Oh. I love that it's got an iPad on its stomach. That's so cute.
Pepper is 4 feet tall, 62 pounds. Tablet-style display on its chest.
Tablet-style.
Tablet-style. And apparently he speaks Japanese. 12 hours battery life.
I wonder if they named it after Pepper in the Iron Man movies. That would be funny.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Like Tony Stark's companion, assistant. That would be so great. But I want one. If it's under $2,000, I'm totally kidding.
I bought that stupid Segway that rolls your iPad around for $2,500.
I was going to say, I bought an iBo. When I was in college when I got my iBo.
Well, does it include the iPad? I mean, if it includes the iPad, you can actually make a case for it.
It is not an iPad. It's 16.9. I think it's something else.
It is. It's something.
It's a tablet-like display.
Well, it's obviously not a Surface Pro 3 either.
No, it's a Surface RT. No, it's a Surface RT, Ed, because they couldn't. No, it's not. I'm joking. I'm saying that they couldn't get rid of all those.
This is where they found. This is the market.
They were able to get an incredible deal on them. They went out to right next to the Atari dig.
Right. So all the Surface RT dig.
You get a free ET cartridge with every robot. It's a great thing. Our show brought to you by Stamps.com. I drove by the post office the other day and I waved as I drove by. It's in Petaluma. It's a beautiful old edifice. And I have a really strong feeling of, affection for the mail carrier, for the post office. When I was a kid, it always meant something good was coming in the mail. But God knows, as you get a business and you start doing mailing in your business, whether it's bills or flyers or fulfillment, maybe you're selling Etsy or Amazon, the post office becomes this kind of nightmare in your eyes. Somewhere you got to go, you got to buy stamps, you got to stand behind the little old lady who's mailing 18 packages to her grandchildren. It's just not fun anymore. Fortunately, Stamps.com lets you do anything you would do at the post office, right from your desk, right at work, 24/7, full-time, on-demand access, not just to postage. And by the way, yes, you could print your own official U.S. postage from your computer and your printer. You don't need anything special, no postage meter, no special inks. But it's a whole lot more. Stamps.com will take addresses from your address book, from your QuickBooks, from your Etsy site or your Amazon or eBay site, automatically fill them in. It'll fill in the international mailing forms. It gets you discounts on all kinds of mail that you just can't even get at the post office. It's really all about doing the fulfillment. They even have a USB scale, and I'm going to show you how you can get that for free, that will allow you to fully automate it so you're always paying exactly the right amount. Even when the postage changes, it just happens on Stamps.com. And then the mail carrier comes. In fact, there's even a button in Stamps.com's interface that says, get the mail carrier out here. So even if you miss the first pickup, you can schedule another one free. Stamps.com. You even get discounted package insurance, all with one click. I want you to try it. Go to Stamps.com. If you do mailing in your business, just go to stamps.com. There's a little special thing I want you to do. You might see on the front page a good deal, but I want you to click the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner because we've got an even better deal. Use the offer code TWIT, and you get a $110 bonus value. You get a $55 in postage coupons, free postage over the first few months of your account. You get the digital scale for free. You just pay shipping and handling on that. That's $5. They'll make it up to you with a $5 supply kit. And, of course, you get a 4-week free trial of stamps.com, a $110 value. Visit stamps.com, click the radio microphone, use the offer code TWIT. If you are still going to the post office, stop. The anniversary of Tetris 30 years ago today. Surely, Christina, you did not play Tetris when you were 5 years old.
No, I got a Game Boy. So I was only like one when the game was released, but I played, I got a Game Boy when I was seven. And I used to play Tetris on it so much that I would dream in Tetris.
That's it, you win!
And apparently, though, that's actually not uncommon. There's something called, I can't think of the name of it, but there's apparently, it's like a phenomenon that they named after Tetris, where people play types of games that they see, you know, the pieces in their
thoughts. You see blocks, yeah.
And you dream about it. And that would happen. I love Tetris so much. That is, if I have to think about like one game or one puzzle game I could play for the rest of my life, it would be that or Bejeweled, and I think Tetris would probably win.
Oh, I love Bejeweled, too. It's all pattern matching, right?
Yeah.
Tetris is available on every platform. Originally written by a guy from Russia.
Yep.
Alexei Pajitnov. I interviewed him when he first came to the United States. His English was very poor, very strong Russian accent. And I say, Alexei, what did you get paid for the rights to distribute Tetris in the United States? And he said, they gave me IBM PC. I said, that's it? He said, yes. I was very happy. In Moscow, in the Soviet Union in 1984, an IBM PC was like solid gold. By 1988, Tetris was everywhere. I really liked Alexei. He really was an interesting guy, very sweet guy, and never did make a huge amount of money off of Tetris, but he did create an amazing thing. In fact, eventually the Soviet Union took over Tetris. And seriously, they're the ones Atari paid for the rights
to. People's skin.
Right. Well, Atari paid and then ended up having to bury those cartridges in the desert. Well, no, because the Tengen version of Tetris for the NES was ruled illegal, that it wasn't officially licensed.
Because they didn't license it. Right.
Right. They got it from the Soviet Union licensed it to somebody for the Tandy, and then the Tandy developer sublicensed it to someone at Atari, and then they made the console version. But Nintendo had licensed it directly from whoever was running the licensing stuff.
Wow.
And so Nintendo won. It was this huge court battle. It went on for a couple of years. Atari had to, scrap the whole thing. Those cartridges, if you can find one, there are very few that are out in the wild, are worth a tremendous amount of money. The guy who I spoke actually with, the guy who runs Tetris Holdings, which is the company that does all the licensing, and the different gyrations, both because of the Soviet Union at the time, and also the fact that it was a burgeoning like home computer and console market at the time. There should be, and there isn't, but there should be a book just on all the weird licensing stuff that's happened with Tetris. It's fascinating. But EA, owns the game and publishes it.
And by the way, does a crap job of it.
They do. But Tetris.com and TetrisFriends.com are the ones that Alexei and this other guy still maintain control over. And you can actually play the Game Boy version of Tetris, complete with the music and in black and white, and like a little flash thing at TetrisFriends.com, which is always fun.
That's awesome. And so Tetris.com, I mean, there's a lot of ads and stuff, but you can play it, and that's the key. I love it. In fact, there's a Gazelle ad and an Xfinity ad. I love it.
Because they knew you were there, Leo.
They knew it was me. They've been following me.
Those were personalized ads.
I was going to say, thanks, Google.
Those are tailored.
What's your highest score? Do you remember?
Oh, I've scored over 1 million several times. I mean, over 10 million, because you get like a really huge rocket if you do that after you get to a certain level. But I mean, I've wasted so many hours of my youth and not so much youth playing this game. It's not even.
I played the Spectrum Holobyte version a lot. That was and it had great music and backgrounds. Russian.
Yeah, that was like the definitive PC version,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah,
it definitely. But I mostly played it on the Game Boy. Yeah. And in fact, until they stopped making versions of the Game Boy that would accept the original 8-bit cartridges, I think it was the Game Boy Advance SP was the last one. I still have that and the original Tetris cartridge someplace in my apartment. That a good 20 something years after I first got, almost 25 years after I got that game for Christmas, I still play it sometimes.
I'm actually glad you're here, because maybe you can identify this picture. Steven Wozniak and his wife Janet playing Tetris head to head. What are those devices? Are those Game Boy Colors?
Those are Game Boys. No, those are that's a Game Boy Color, and yes, those are two Game Boy Colors that came out. Not Game Boy Colors. They were the original Game Boy, but they released some that were in colors, so there you could get it in green or clear, and then that cable is a link cable, the Game Boy link cable, which wasn't used with many games until Pokemon. Pokemon made it very popular, but it would plug into the side of the Game Boy. But those are two full-size Game Boys those are two full-size Game Boys that are see-through. They might be the Game Boy Colors. I can't tell from the size of the device, but I know exactly what that is. Yeah.
It was and his wife, Janet, who I love dearly, were waiting for the bus. This was a couple of years ago. We were on a cruise in South America, And they whipped out their Game Boys and they played head-to-head Tetris.
The fact that they care, they go around with two of those and the link cable, that's so cool. That's so cool. Like, honestly, this is why we love you, Woz. That's why Woz is like the ultimate nerd and we all love him so much. You know, we shouldn't listen to any of his predictions about Apple ever because no, but he's like, he's the every geek, you know, he's one of us.
And that's why we love Chris.
He and his wife are both wearing iWatches.
They're wearing iPod Nano watches. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's probably the TikToks or the Lunatic, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on his left hand, he's got, of course, got his Nixie watch, which has Nixie tubes that show the time.
total nerd.
Nerd it's, geek it's heaven.
Just,
yep.
It just it makes me feel so normal.
Say, Christina Warren, you have earned incredible geek cred that you were able to immediately identify the hardware that you were using, and we are just so thrilled. We love having you on the show. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being here. Christina writes for Mashable Film Girl on Twitter @film_girl. And always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being here. I'm so glad the internet worked today.
Yes, I'm so glad it didn't fail. And I'm so glad to be on with my Twitter pal, Ed.
It's so, you know what? This was fun. We should do this more often. This was a lot of fun. Ed Bott, okay. Maybe every Sunday. I don't know. Ed Bott writes for ZDNet. You can find his great columns there. Occasionally he'll appear on our Windows Weekly show or, you know, just around here and there. And, old friend and a new friend, but I think you guys are the greatest. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Leo. And thanks, Christina. It was fun.
Really fun. She's such a geek.
I am.
God. You're just a font of knowledge. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you want to join us live, the chat room and your live participation always make it a lot more fun for me, so I love it if you can. But if not, don't worry. We've got on-demand audio and video available at twit.tv and wherever you get your netcasts, iTunes, Xbox Music, the podcast apps on your phone or your desktop. And, of course, if you have the Twit apps, and we have a number. We don't write any of them, but our third-party developers do a great job on iOS, on Android, on Windows Phone. That's another great way to get every episode. Don't miss an episode each and every week of This Week in Tech. Thanks to our producer, Chad Johnson, who put together a fabulous lineup of stories that we didn't even begin to scratch the surface of. There's so much more we could talk about. Thank you, Chad. But we'll just have to do that another day. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
In the can. Thank you, everybody. And a lovely live audience.